Please be advised, the audio in this podcast contains profanity. From NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras here in Washington, D.C. Now, as you may know, Jasmine Garst has been in Mexico scouting out new music for us, but she's also been looking for artists, writers, and thinkers who help us understand our world a little better. This week, she sits down with writer Oscar Martinez, a journalist from El Salvador who followed a trail of immigrants from Central America as they tried to make their way to the U.S. He wrote about it in his new book called The Beast, which is being published in English this month. He traveled on top of the train called The Beast, or La Bestia, which carries men, women, and children through what he called the darkest crevices of Mexico on a dangerous journey that often includes robbery, murder, and rape. A word of warning, though, there are disturbing stories of death and sexual violence in this week's show that you should know about before listening in. In this show, we are presenting a translation of Jasmine's interview with Oscar Martinez, which was originally done in Spanish. You can hear the interview in Spanish in a separate podcast. This week, the show is about words, not music. The bit of music you will hear is from Gustavo Santaolalla's 1998 album, Ronroco. We think it's perfect for reflecting on the power of Oscar Martinez's words and stories.
When you speak to Central American migrants who are on their way to the U.S., do you ever ask what they expect the U.S. to be like?
Sí, fíjate que lo conversamos muchas veces, que la frase construida del sueño americano se cayó y se cayó hace tantos años ya.
We've discussed it a lot. The idea of the American dream, it's fallen apart. It fell apart many years ago. Among the migrants, nobody believes in the existence of this bonanza of the 80s and 90s in the U.S. No migrant believes that he won't break his back in the U.S. First of all, to pay the coyote, the person he pays to bring himself to the U.S., which his family probably helped him pay for, and how complicated it is to find work in the U.S. The idea of quick, instant progress, of being able to come back home to your country in a few years, dressed in a Lakers t-shirt and some Nike shoes, and that you'll be able to invite your whole family to the beach for the weekend. That fantasy fell apart a long time ago. This is the story that trickles down among the migrants who come in and out of the U.S. Life is hard there. There are a lot of people, more and more each day, who know that they go to the U.S. to work like animals, to be able to save, to be able to pay for a warm bed, to be able to send back some money. On average, Salvadorans send $70 a month back home. It's not a lot.
You've ridden on top of the beast, or La Bestia, 8 times. Now, for listeners who don't know what the beast is, could you explain?
Mira, la bestia es el tren de carga que en el que viajan los migrantes como polizones colgados de su techo en los balcones entre medio de los vagones.
The beast is the cargo train in which migrants ride, like vagabonds, on the roof, hanging from the sides, in between cars and on the balconies. There are 2 routes, one on the Pacific coast, which leaves from Tapachula, the classic route, which has been used since the 70s, and the other route, a newer one, a much more dangerous one, which leaves from Tabasco, close to the Atlantic. What is the beast? The beast is a myth in the immigrant world. The beast is one of the most intense moments of the journey of an undocumented immigrant coming in through Mexico. It is the moment in which one of the most indestructible bonds, even if they are brief, among those who ride it. It's almost a family bond. You bond with people, people who will be taking care of your son, and who you will care for, people who will care for your wife, and those whose wife will take care of you. The bond with the fellow traveler who carries a club in his hand to defend himself from the assault of which you too will be a victim. The beast is a community that moves in solidarity through the darkest crevices of Mexico. And above all, the beast is a place where migrants are at the mercy of what springs up from the mountains. If the Zeta drug gang comes down from the mountains, then you must face that. Perhaps 2 thugs with a .38 gun will come from the mountains, which is usually the case. That is what you must face.
I know this might seem like a very basic question, but what is it like to travel on top of that train for so long?
La primera que te puedo describir es la de una intensidad terrible. Yo recuerdo la primera vez que yo me subí a la bestia, me subí en un pueblo que está en medio de Chiapas y Oaxaca, es decir, entre Arriaga y Ixtepec.
It's terribly intense. The first time I hopped onto the beast, I did it in a town between Chiapas and Oaxaca, between Arriaga and Ixtepec. We caught the train as it was running, and it dragged me, because I did everything I was told not to do, by a coyote who had explained to me how to jump on the moving train. He said, board it with the leg that is closest to it, run next to the train, take its pulse with one of your hands, pull yourself up with your arms onto the car so that your legs make no effort, and don't get sucked in by the wheels. I did none of those things. The first time, it was terrifying. And then I got so bored. It's 11 hours and the sun is burning your head. There comes a point in which you are bored. You just want to get there. You want to take a shower and get off the train. In the southern part, from Ixtepec to Veracruz, at night I felt so scared. And not because of the speed at which the train is going. Fear because you know that every stop you go through, they are stops completely dominated by the Zeta gang. And then you start asking yourself, what just moved? Why did that light just turn on in the car behind me? Why did the train stop for 20 minutes in this empty field? So you ask yourself these things, and the whole time you are alert with this incredible adrenaline, trying to understand what the train is trying to tell you. As a journalist, I felt an immense solidarity with the people on that train. Perhaps the best place to interview someone is on the roof of that train. But on top of that train, for at least one moment, people forget about your little tape recorder and your notebook and your pen, and they see that the distance between the tracks and your feet is the same as the distance between their feet and the tracks. We are going at the same speed, and it's just one moment in which the migrant workers feel that you are very similar to them.
Your book, which is now being released in English in the U.S., is called The Beast. In Spanish, it's called Los Migrantes Que No Importan, or The Migrants Who Don't Matter. And I'm wondering, why did you choose to name it that?
Mira, es gente que no vota. Es gente que no denuncia, no denuncia.
Look, it's people who don't vote. It's people who don't report crimes. Central American migrants in Mexico believe, and rightfully so, that the authorities are their enemies. To ask a migrant who managed to escape a kidnapping at the hands of the Zeta gang, go tell the Mexican authorities. That's the equivalent of asking a soldier to go to the enemy and ask them for water. They traveled through a part of Mexico that's unbeknownst to most. Most Mexicans from the capital could not tell you the name of five towns these people passed through. Obviously, their home countries could care less about them. Not El Salvador, not Nicaragua, not Honduras, not Guatemala. None of them have the decency to join voices and demand that something change in the well-being of their citizens. The authorities who should care don't give a fuck.
Las autoridades que deberían de importarles, les importan un carajo.
You've been doing this for many years, and in the last few years, the number of Central American immigrants coming to the U.S. has grown exponentially. And the amount of children who are coming, especially children who are coming without adults alone, is also growing. How have things changed in the last few years for migrants?
Todos tenemos parientes allá y tenemos historias de éxito en el cruce.
We all have relatives in the U.S. and success stories when it comes to their crossing the border. I remember my aunt crossed into San Diego, and it took her just a few hours to cross the border. They went in through Tijuana and saw the beaches the color of café con leche and the buildings of San Diego. It was the 80s. There are pictures of the Border Patrol dressed as Santa Claus on the 24th of December, giving presents to children who were crossing. These were different times. Migration today, with this wall, it's difficult. First of all, it changed because of different operations in the 90s. Gatekeeper, Hold the Line, Jumpstart in 2006. After all that, the biggest change that affected migrants was when the Zeta gang discovered that these poor, ragged vagabonds traveling on a steel worm could be squeezed for money. And that's when the history of Central Americans changed. Before that, you didn't hear about mass kidnapping, about entire systems in place to force women into brothels, where they were raped. You heard about gangs assaulting you in the south, La Mara Salvatrucha, thefts on top of trains. Today, immigration has changed completely. One wrong step can lead to a horrible death. To face all this, Los Zetas, the train and its tearing apart of people, the rough northern border, you don't do that because you're hungry. If you're hungry, you ask for money from house to house. You pick food out of the trash. You do that because of that beautiful human feeling, the feeling, the thought that there is something that can be better for you in this life, the need to progress, the need for your children to not fuck it up as bad as you did. I think that's the feeling that keeps people moving between Central America and the U.S. That and the need to see your family, to see your wife again, to see your children, to see your parents who left for the U.S. in the 80s. And you're sick and tired of your family being split up.
Yo creo que ese es el sentimiento que mantiene un flujo constante. Ese y la necesidad de volver a ver a tus parientes, de volver a ver a tu mujer, de volver a ver a tus hijos, de volver a ver a tus padres que se fueron en los 80s y que ya estás harto de que la familia esté partiendo.
When I've spoken to friends about coming to the U.S., who came on the Beast, something that struck me was details. Details like, you know, what if I run out of water? And I'm wondering what kind of details you learned on this trip.
Sí, el tren está lleno de detalles. Fíjate que esta es una parte que... Cuando arriba del tren empezás a conocer los códigos.
Yes, the train is filled with details. On the train you start learning codes, and one thing you learn is that the train roof is made of fiberglass, and that it's really irritating when the fiberglass gets stuck in your ass as you travel. You always have to have some cardboard to sit on. Also, you always have to pick a train car that has holes in it. Migrants call it egg cartons. So you sit on that, you take your belt off, and tie yourself to the train roof, so that if you fall asleep, you don't fall off. You learn that if at night, a light goes on ahead of you, like a flashlight, it goes on and off, and it starts advancing toward you, you know that people are getting robbed. It's the thugs that are coming towards you with the flashlights, getting on and off each car. You learn to read the tracks and to know which train is going to depart on which track. You learn you must not step in the joint between two cars, because that is called the Beast's Bite, and it's destroyed and ripped apart many feet. You learn that water is the most precious thing. The train only obeys the delivery schedule for the day. If the train stops midway because it has to receive cargo and it stays there for 3 days, then you are stuck for 3 days. The train is a series of codes, and those who ignore the codes, which is most migrants, tend to have a very rough journey.
Any time I've spoken to Central Americans about this journey, Central Americans who have come on the Beast, of course, I'm always taken aback by the magnitude and the terror and the horror of this situation. But I'm also taken aback by the courage. And this is a very difficult book. There's so much violence. There's so much desesperación, so much hopelessness. But I also wanted to ask, what have you found that you love about these people, that you love about your people?
Mira, yo lo que amo profundamente de los y las salvadoreñas es su profundo arraigo por la vida.
Look, what I love profoundly about Salvadoran men and women, it's their profound grip on life. I believe that in the midst of so much death, in El Salvador, there are people who have such a difficult life, and you still feel you have the right to progress. I think if that is not an example of life triumphing over death, then I don't know what is. You arrive in the U.S. after all these days of traveling through the hell that is Mexico for a migrant, so that you can have a job which is animalistic in its physical demands, so you can barely sleep, so you can miss your family, so you can keep on living in a house with 20, 30 people, with the daily fear that immigration is going to come and pick you up. And if that is not the example of the human will to live, I don't know what to call it. I think the desire to live that Guatemalans, Hondurans, Salvadorans, and Nicaraguans have is exemplary.
I'm wondering how it feels like to be from a place in which such an overwhelming amount of people are thinking about leaving at some point. Like the goal is to leave. And certainly in a lot of Latin American countries, a lot of people would like to leave, but not with the urgency, perhaps, that somebody from Guatemala, which has been overtaken by violence.
Mira. Es como es, yo creo que todo eso tiene relación. Es un lugar, los lugares donde la gente se quiere ir es necesariamente un lugar amargo, un lugar violento.
It is what it is. Places in which people are always trying to leave are by nature bitter places, violent places. El Salvador has an entire generation that has been raised only by their mothers, and entire generations raised only by their grandmothers. I don't know what we would have done in El Salvador were it not for the grandmothers. It's a place where families are profoundly divided and frustrations are huge. It's a lie that children don't resent the absence of parents, simply because that is the way things have been for a long time. Places where it would seem that all the youth, all the desire to keep on going, it's in the U.S. It's extremely complicated, and there are larger implications. To be a country so set on going to the U.S., has turned it into a violent country.
One of the hardest chapters in your book starts and ends with a rape. And I was reading the statistics that at least 60% of Central American female migrants are raped on this journey. And that's only the cases that get reported. Because as you mentioned, most of these cases for fear go unreported. And you also wrote that very few people think about these non-physical traumas, the psychological traumas. And you write that female migrants have this mentality, this is going to happen to me. I hope it doesn't, but it will. And I'm trying to grasp a community in which 60% or more of women are raped. What have you noticed is the impact of that?
Hay estudios que te indican que las mujeres que han sido violadas tardan un promedio entre 2 y 3 años en querer contarlo a alguien.
There are studies indicating that when women are raped, they take 2 to 3 years to be able to talk about it. And they speak about the profound wound of self-hatred. The beating against one's dignity that it is to be raped. Many of these rapes are executed with extreme sadism. In the southern Mexican state of Chiapas, in a place called La Arocera, I'm referring to the common practice of raping a woman in front of her family, her partner. The message being that you are to be submissive. I can't understand the profound disgust toward these migrants. Look, I don't know what to tell you. All I understand is that a society like this is a society with so many problems, problems of disgust, of distance, of loneliness. Not telling anyone what happened to you is undoubtedly a symptom of loneliness. And you discover, when they finally tell you that they were raped, you discover the profound desire they had to tell someone, and for someone to listen to them. And they tell you once, and then again, and they start remembering details. And they can't stop the flow of words, even when you think you can no longer endure their story. It's obvious that these people want to tell their stories, but nobody's waiting for this battered community on the other side. Nobody's asking, hey, what happened to you?
What has to change?
Bueno, yo lo que creo que México es experto en crear autoridades inútiles.
Mexico is a master of creating authorities that are completely useless. They have to create an authority that gives more visibility to the issue. Not an authority that gives food and water to migrants in transit. I'm talking about an authority that brings criminals to justice. Because the only way to have a healthy society is to have a society that understands, if you do this, the state will do this to you. But in the case of immigrants passing through Mexico, it's like, if you do this, you're going to get money. And that's it. And at the arrival point, the U.S. has to allow civil organizations to document the stories of people who arrive there, regardless of whether or not they're documented. Central America needs to stop being so lazy and start asking people about their stories, even if it's piecemeal. And it needs to start enforcing the law, set a precedent for justice. And Mexico. Mexico needs to start worrying about a population of thousands and thousands of people passing through its territory.
What you do is incredibly risky. Riding the beast once is risky. Riding it 8 times, that's a Russian roulette. And it's gotten more and more risky. And I wanted to ask you, why do you do this?
Lo que menos quiero es que suene a una postura heroica. El periodismo es un trabajo.
The last thing I want is to sound like a hero. Journalism is a job. There are people who are locksmiths, some people are carpenters. Journalism is a job like that. And I believe that journalism, like every other profession, has an ethics to it. And the ethics of journalism forces me to say, I pick this topic to cover. I must cover it as the rain pours. Meaning if it's raining outside, I also have to get wet. I can't cover a topic like this from an office. But then it was necessary. How could I describe a trip on a train that I've never been on? If I've never made that voyage, I actually think 8 trips wasn't enough. I would have liked to have done more.
What signs of humanity did you see on the road? And what gave you hope?
Yo, la primera que tengo que mencionar por orden es Alejandro Solalinde y Pedro Pantoja.
Well, I must first mention Father Alejandro Solalinde and Pedro Pantoja. Alejandro Solalinde is the priest who founded and runs a migrant shelter in Ixtepec, Oaxaca, southern Mexico. And Pedro Pantoja created and runs a shelter in Saltillo, Mexico. These are men who've been threatened by the Zeta gang. There's this article by my friend Emiliano Ruiz Parra entitled, To Love God in the Land of Zetas. It's easier to love God in church than it is to love God in the land of the Zetas gang. These men have given me so much hope. I've seen Father Solalinde stop a train with his car. I've seen Father Solalinde ride the train. I've seen him get threatened. I've seen him almost get set on fire in front of his shelter. There's a group in Veracruz called Las Patronas, which filled me with awe. The head of Las Patronas, Doña Leonila, doesn't have much, but she fills a bag with food and water and goes to the train tracks to give it to the people. People will never be able to say thank you enough. There are people whose names she'll never know. Sometimes people yell their names at her, so she knows who she's helped. And I was struck by her reasoning. Doña Leonila told me once why she takes food to the tracks. She said, because one time one of those travelers fell off the train, and when I saw him there, he said he was hungry. And when he said that, I asked myself, what would I feel if my son, who is that age, was hungry? And I thought I would feel terrible.
I have one last question for you, and this is something I ask myself often, and I think it's something that on Alt Latino we try to answer. When I hear these stories, like the ones you tell in your book about migrants, I can't help but think, you are Latino, and I'm Latina. But what is it that unites us as one people beyond a common language, Spanish?
Mira, yo creo que una de las cuestiones que los latinoamericanos tenemos en común y por eso vos ves algunos países que se diferencian
Look, I think one thing Latin Americans have in common. This is my belief, and you can criticize it if you want. It's the difficulties we've endured to be where we are today. The profound difficulties, the civil wars, all the goddamn military dictatorships we've had to face for so long, the injustice. What that generated is the profound social gap between those who have so much and those who have so little. I believe that is what makes us who we are. And makes us feel empathy. I feel empathy for a Honduran. I feel empathy for the radically dark sense of humor of a Guatemalan I met on the journey, who joked with me about how he'd been kidnapped and they wanted to steal his organs. And we laughed all afternoon about that on the train tracks. I think this has built in us a personality that has its dark side, it has its bad side, but I identify with it. I think in the U.S. you can see that sometimes we're not very compassionate with each other. If there are undocumented people listening to this show in the U.S. right now, you know that once you get there, there are so many obstacles. And that's the dark side. You learn generation after generation that the basic tenet of living is that you must survive, however you can, with whatever you can. That's part of our DNA.
Te quiero agradecer muchísimo por sentarte y hablar conmigo sobre tu libro, sobre tus experiencias. Muchas gracias.
Gracias a vos por el espacio.
That was writer Oscar Martinez talking about his new book, The Beast. You know, immigration is a subject we often touch on here in Alt Latino, and this won't be the last time it pops up on our radar. So, drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know what you think about this show, the subject, or whatever else is on your mind that you think we should cover here on Alt Latino. Oscar Martinez came up with a playlist of songs that reflects the subjects he talked about, and you can find that playlist on our website at npr.org/altlatino. And don't forget about our 24/7 stream, where you can hear the music we've played on all of our shows. From NPR Music in Washington, D.C., I'm Felix Contreras, and this has been Alt Latino.